This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. Massachusetts hits another major reopening benchmark today, step two of phase two for those who are keeping score at home. That means personal services, which require close contact, like nail salons, tattoo parlors, massage therapists, they can reopen with new restrictions. It also means restaurants can serve food indoors, again with new state safety guidelines. Here with us to discuss how they're thinking about this development are two restaurant owners. Nia Grace is the proprietor and general manager of Daryl's Corner Bar and Kitchen in the South End. Nia, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Rob Anderson, co-owner and chef at the Canteen in Provincetown. Rob, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we're going to open the phones up on this one as well. So are you excited to go eat at your favorite restaurant, or are you too nervous to be doing indoor dining at this point? Or are you a restaurant owner, manager, server? How are you thinking about the reopening process, specifically in terms of restaurants? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Rob, I want to start with you. We had checked in with you a couple of weeks ago. You'd cleared out your whole indoor space and turned your front window into a takeout window. I'm curious, is that still what you guys have in terms of a setup for your restaurant?
Yeah, that's how we have everything set up. Since we last talked, we have added our outdoor seating area. So we have about 100 seats now in our backyard on the ocean that we've been serving people at for about a week now.
So because of that, you've kind of given up your indoor dining space. Is that something you're thinking about bringing back, or where's your mindset at on that?
Well, for us out here, we're on Cape Cod. We're on the ocean. So for us, most of the folks who are coming to dine with us want to be outside on the water anyway. So it works for us, you know, it works well for us now, and we don't plan on adding in our indoor seating this summer.
So you're going to remain exclusively outdoor dining throughout the summer?
Exactly, and not only is it a great way for people to obviously enjoy the ocean and the outside, but I do feel like it's a bit safer for our guests and our customers and our workers at this point as well.
Nia, what about you? You're in the South End, a little bit of a different situation, obviously. I'm guessing your patio's not out on the beach. Are you planning on bringing back indoor dining in the near future?
Well, not in the immediate future. We do have a small patio area already, not as many as 100 seats, and we definitely don't have the ocean view. I have to get down to the canteen soon. But we do have a space, and we are looking to expand into the street. Hopefully we have some restaurants in our area doing the same thing. But indoor dining, I think to Chris's point, too, we're thinking about the safety of our team first and our customers, and we think that trying to navigate the outdoor space is going to be what we need to do right now.
Can you both kind of walk us through some of the health precautions you're taking? I think a lot of folks are curious what the restrictions mean for restaurants from an operating standpoint.
Yeah. I would say that, you know, we've always been on top of, you know, our hygiene and protocols and health and food safety. And we're just adding a couple of layers to it just to really make sure our customers feel comfortable. With that, we're asking our guests to make sure that they wear a mask when they enter the facility, and any time that they have to use restrooms or walk about, that they wear a mask. But whenever their seats off, we're trying to protect them with digital menus. So you can go right on our website, or you can scan a QR code with your phone so that we can, again, reduce contact and touch points. And our staff side, you know, we're making sure that we're wearing gloves, we're wearing masks all times. We're doing health checks when people when our staff is you know, reporting for their shifts to make sure that.
It sounds like we lost Nia there. So Rob, I was going to pivot back to you anyway here.
Sure.
You talked about your outdoor dining situation. Have you made specific changes to what that patio looks like, kind of capacity or setup?
100%, yeah. So for us, we have three ways guests can dine with us. We've created three different individual lines so that we can decrease the amount of people waiting in lines next to other people. So you can either pre-order online, show up, pick up your food, or you can order in person, pick up and go, or you can walk up to our outdoor window, order your food, and walk to the backyard and get a seat. We are eliminating sort of any host situations. So you walk to your table. You know, you eat at a table outside, and then you actually bus your own table, and our guests I mean, our staff only interacts with you sort of to say goodbye and then sanitizes your table as you leave. And the same as your other guests, as the other guests explained, we are limiting the number of people who can come inside the restaurant. So it's just our staff. Our staff is wearing masks and gloves at all times. We're even trying to keep all of our staff 6 feet apart as they're working. So there's different stations that we're trying to really remain socially distant from each other as much as we can. You know, and we're obviously, as restaurant owners, we are already very attuned and very capable of keeping everybody safe and healthy and watching temperatures, watching for safety measures. But this is just adding an extra layer on top of it all. And a lot of the difficulty comes in communicating those extra measures to guests. So guests that are returning to restaurants for the first time might be expecting things to be just like they were back a couple months ago. But there are, we're sort of operating in a new way. We're all familiar with those regulations because we've been sort of implementing them, but it adds an extra layer that we have to sort of communicate those changes to our guests and then enforce it when they aren't following the rules. So that's another difficulty that we're facing.
Yeah, I'm sure that's a tough balance to strike. You mentioned distancing when possible. I want to play a quick cut here. We spoke to Tommy McCarthy earlier today. He's the owner of the Buren in Somerville, and they are opening for indoor dining starting today. Here's how he described what his dining room looks like.
You won't be able to sit at the bar, so there'll be no bar stove. And then tables and chairs will be 6 feet apart. We normally seat... we don't see, but our capacity is 260, so now we will be at 65 people inside.
So, Nia, that sounds like a pretty stark drop-off in terms of capacity. Is that similar to what you're planning, and what kind of challenges does that present to you as the owner?
Absolutely. We're typically able to seat 70 guests. And with our reduction with the social distancing, we're going to be reduced to 30. So that's under half of what we have. We're also unable to have anybody at bar seats. And again, that's statewide in terms of rules. And for us, the challenge comes in because a third and very critical part of our business is live entertainment. We do live music. We have bands that are 4 to 5 pieces, singers. How are our customers going to respond to that? And, you know, we're actually asking them, how do you feel about it? And are you going to be okay with it? We're a very intimate venue, so that is one of our challenges.
And so go ahead, Rob.
I would add that, you know, I think restaurant owners and restaurant workers, we're probably some of the most scrappy, optimistic, mm-hmm. hardworking people out there in America. So all of us are going at this with our best intentions. We want to fight. We want to keep going. We want to keep our staff employed. I don't think that if any restaurant isn't hitting, you know, 50% capacity or more, I think they're bound to close. I don't think many restaurants are going to make it. Even as we reopen, I'm sorry to be a Debbie Downer, but you know, we're all going to do our best, but there's going to be massive amount of restaurants that even as we open up, we're not going to be able to hit. We already operate on incredibly small margins. So those restaurants that aren't going to be able to hit that capacity or fill those seats, they're just not going to be able to. There's no way it can work out. There's absolutely no way.
So that echoes what the Massachusetts Restaurant Association has estimated, that we could lose about 3,600 restaurants, which would be about a quarter of the restaurants in Massachusetts. That, I would imagine, presents a tough balance for you. Rob, you talked about trying to enforce these restrictions with diners, but you also obviously have to maintain some sort of friendly relationship with your customers. You, as you just said, need them more than ever in order to stay in business. Let me throw this to both of you guys. How do you find that balance in terms of making sure that everyone's following the right rules and restrictions, but also trying not to turn off any potential business?
These have been some of the toughest weeks of my life, I can say. So I'm out here on Cape Cod, you know, so we sort of wait for the influx of people every year, and it's a double-edged sword for this year. You know, so either people don't come and we lose all that money and we won't be able to reopen again, or people do come and we make money, but we are risking the health of our community. So I've been sitting out here on Cape Cod watching my restaurant as it sits empty, worrying about the financial stability of my staff and my community here. now the summer's here and we are filling with people. Town is filling up. The summer is here. Folks are acting like it's sort of a normal summer. So on the one hand, my backyard is filling up at the canteen. I am happy. That makes part of me happy. I'm making sales. I'm able to pay my bills, but I am so concerned about the health of my staff, of my family, of my community. But what can we do? You know, we're stuck. We're stuck. There's ups and downs to both sides, and we don't know. We don't know what to do, and we're just doing our best.
Yeah.
Nia, what about you? Yeah,
I would second that, and you know, all of that, and the emotion that comes with it. But for us, I think the safety is first and foremost. And so, if a guest decides to come here and they don't want to wear a mask, or they come without a mask, and that's one of our requirements, and we feel that would be helpful, we have masks for guests. You know, so we make it one of those things where I think that our guests are they support us, right? And so if they support us, they'll support these changes that we're all having to go with. And so I think that it's been tough in general, but I think my experience with our guests have been that they're understanding and that they're in this with us, and that's why they're here supporting us. And if that means we have to, you know, sit 6 feet apart, wear a mask, whatever it is, they're here for it. And I think that that's where they're coming from.
Yeah, I would say we've had about 85% compliance, I would say. The vast majority of people that come are on the same page, are very supportive, and then we get about 15% of folks who really don't want to follow the rules, and then we have to step up and explain to them the rules and be the enforcers.
Okay.
So to that point, and I'll throw this to both of you again, what are you guys hearing from your servers? That obviously puts your servers in a role where they have to be enforcers with some of these customers. I'm sure that's not an easy role for them to play. What are you hearing in terms of feedback from your employees?
Yeah, they're exhausted. They're stressed out. They're exhausted. They're worried. They're doing their best. And, you know, again, everyone's putting a positive face. We're in the hospitality business, so it's our job to welcome people and to be as positive and upbeat as we can. But when the shift is done, everyone is really stressed out and tired right now. It's my job to support all of my staff and keep them motivated and happy and healthy and safe. And I can tell you, at the end of the night, when I check in with everybody, it's been very difficult for them. Mm-hmm. And you know, these are immigrant workers. These are young people. These are people who don't necessarily have a strong safety net. So they need to be making money. They need to be working. They're trying to pay for their kids' educations, for their kids' shoes, for their health insurance. And they're already worried financially, and now they're also worried and stressed out from their jobs.
Yeah.
Nia, what about you? Yeah, have you heard from your staff?
Yeah, so we just kind of lightly stepped into the outdoor dining for the last two weekends. We've been doing primarily takeout, and so with a small team, for which most of it had to be managers or more senior staff, we all know how to make that communication with the customer. And what we've actually had to deal with, more of our customers that we've seen over the last 3 months, have 80% of them have in fact been third-party drivers, you know, facilitating, you know, a delivery for our customers. And now those have been the hardest to really get them to comply. It's like they have nothing to lose, and that has been frustrating. You know, staff is really frustrated. Like, it's something about these last 3 months for us in terms of, like, takeout and having to have interaction with our customers, because, again, it's not what we're used to. It's not, you know, we're able to see if our customer is enjoying themselves or needs a little bit of attention or something like that, so we can make sure that their experience is a top-notch. This third-party interaction that we're doing with Grubhub and Uber Eats has been the most frustrating time that I think any of us have had to experience, plus on top of in the middle of the pandemic and the precautions and the different things that we have to deal with. So, again, we'll continue to echo that. We are actually tired. It has been a bit frustrating, but I'll say I think that for our customer base that is returning to us, they are, you know, I think full on with compliance. They care. So.
Yeah, so on that note, let me, and I'm sorry we didn't have time for calls in this segment, but let me ask you guys, what's the most important message you'd like to send to those who are thinking about dining out again, whether it be indoors or outdoors?
Mm-hmm. I'd say we miss you. We're safe, and we've been preparing ourselves to welcome you back, and we're just asking for understanding, patience, and consideration when you return.
Yeah, and I would obviously echo that sentiment. We are so happy to be welcoming people back. We have made a commitment to our guests to be open, to provide them with the best food and best service in the safest possible way that we can. We're working so hard to do it, and all that we ask in return is you know, to come in with maybe a little extra level of sort of patience and care, and you know, realize that we're all in this together. And but we do want everybody to know that we do really appreciate their support.
That's Rob Anderson, co-owner and chef at the Canteen in Provincetown, and Nia Grace, proprietor and general manager of Daryl's Corner Bar and Kitchen in the South End. Thank you both so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having us.
Today kicks off a new regular segment for Radio Boston. We're calling it Writers on Writers. We'll talk with writers not about their own work, but about other writers whose work they admire. And this summer we'll be focusing on books that help us understand race in America. Today, we wanted to start by looking through the lens of children's books. Joining me now is Jabari Asim. He's a writer, a professor of writing and publishing at Emerson College, and he's also written several books and poems about the Black experience in America. His most recent book, which came out just last week, is called Stop and Frisk, American Poems. He's also the author of 9 children's books and a fan of many more. Jabari, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So I will get into some specific choices you've made for us in just a moment, but I want to start by asking you about kind of this current moment we're in. We've seen sustained protests and demonstrations over the last few weeks. It seems like we're having serious conversations about police reform. It feels like it's at least possibly a historic moment, the way we're talking about race and racism. So how do we help our kids understand where we're at, and how can books help us do that?
Well, you know, books help us look at the narrative from sort of the beginning, particularly the African-American experience in this instant, up to the present. And, you know, there's this cliche that if we don't know our history, we are doomed to repeat it. So even as we understand the present, we can look at these other narratives that have described other periods that have been, you know, similar in particular ways and different in other ways, but help us develop some kind of critical understanding of what's happening now, and, you know, perhaps shape our optimism or our viewpoint in terms of what can happen next.
So let's look at some specific examples you've picked out for us. First pick I want to highlight is All Us Come Across the Water by Lucille Clifton. Can you tell us a little bit about this book and why you chose it?
Yes, All Us Come Across the Water by the great Lucille Clifton, with illustrations by the great John Steptoe. So we have a combination of really powerful talents. And Lucille Clifton today is best known as a brilliant poet. And it's perhaps not known even to some of her admirers that she wrote a number of children's books in the 1970s. And All Us Come Across the Water came out in 1973. It's about a little Black boy who is struggling with how best to describe his heritage when the teacher asks each student in class to share a story about where their ancestors come from. And so he talked with people in his community, including relatives and elders, in an attempt to sort of pin down exactly where in Africa his people came from. And ultimately he decides that some information is more critical than the details, such as the reality of his people's togetherness and their ability to thrive against, you know, very unfavorable odds. It's a beautiful book.
That's a powerful message. I know you've got an excerpt chosen from the book. Can you read that for us?
Sure. When they stole my daddy's daddy to make him a slave, they didn't ask for his name and he didn't give it. Well, what did they call him? He say, whatever he let him. Reckon he figure if they ain't got his name, they ain't really got him. I say, Big Mama give me my name. It mean unity. He smiled then. He start really talking. Long as your own give you the name, you know it's yours. We name us. Everybody else just calling us something, but we name us.
There's such a big, complex issue there about identity and where we come from. And I'm just kind of wondering, these are talking about really serious themes, racial trauma, violence, some of the most troubling parts of our country's history directly in children's books. Are there extra obstacles in doing that? And why are all us come across the water and some of the others that you've chosen, why are they effective in doing that?
Yeah, actually, All Us Come Across the Water is probably the most subtle of the books that I've chosen. They do talk about people being stolen and that sort of thing. But the others that we'll talk about are perhaps even more direct. And you know, Chris, it really is a fine line. I mean, you want to inform young readers, but you don't want to traumatize them to the extent that they're actually turned off by the idea of reading stories and reading history. And you know, these authors that we're looking at today walk that fine line with considerable skill. At the same time, you know, I believe you should defer to the parents. Some parents will feel that this material is too sensitive for their children to be getting at a young age. And I feel bound to respect that. But there are many of us who are parents and writers and readers who actually want to begin to introduce this kind of material into our children's knowledge base fairly early in their development. And these are the kinds of books that will ideally help us do that.
You mentioned some of your other choices are a little more direct. I want to turn to one of those. Let's talk a little bit about Pink and Say, which is another book that you chose. I read that this morning. Wow.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Patricia Polacco wrote it and illustrated it. And, you know, I can say as a writer, I find this book particularly instructive because she really shows how you can tell this kind of story without soft pedaling it and at the same time not making it so horrible that the child's going to run, you know, throw the book across the room and run screaming away from it. So it tells a moving story of the friendship of two Union soldiers, two very young Union soldiers. They're boys, actually, one black and one white during the Civil War. And their alliance begins on a Georgia battlefield when one saves the life of the other. Polacco upends a number of stereotypes as her story progresses, and she doesn't force a happy ending on us. In fact, the tale of Pink and Say winds up at Andersonville, the notorious Confederate prison. But like some of these other authors that we're looking at today, she sort of successfully advances an argument that shielding young readers from the facts of history does them no favors.
Yeah, you mentioned the ending. We don't have to give specifics in case folks want to check it out
no
for
spoilers.
Themselves. But yeah, exactly. But man, a real gut punch at the end.
Yes.
And there are so many issues in there. You mentioned this during the Civil War. These are folks who are talking about whether they can return to the battlefield or fear of death. I mean, these are heavy, heavy issues for kids. Again, I guess I'm just wondering, what would you say to parents who would say, I don't think really that's appropriate for children's literature?
Well, you know, it's, you know, I'm not a guy who shies away from an argument, but that's not an argument I would necessarily have. I really think you have to respect parents and their instincts. They know their children, right? And I think I would defer if a parent said to me, look, I read this book. It is a terrific book, you're right, but I don't think my child is ready for it. And I would say, well, you know, put it on the shelf, get it out from time to time, and when you feel the time is right, share it with your child. But there are some of us, like I say, who have fewer reservations, and I think, you know, the book works for us, as challenging as it is.
Yeah, I know you've got a reading selected from this one as well. Do you want to share that with us?
Sure. What was your outfit again? Pink asked. He'd asked me before. Ohio 24th, I carried the staff. Wasn't supposed to carry a gun, but then so many died, even us boys had to carry, after so many were slaughtered like hogs. At least you got to carry. In the 48th, we couldn't have guns at first. We fought with sticks and hammers and sledges. Can you imagine not trusting us with our own fight? I couldn't imagine such a thing. Then when they did finally give us muskets, they were from the Mexican-American War. Those muskets jammed and misfired. Then how in God's name can you want to go back? I asked. Because it's my fight, Say. Ain't it yours too? If we don't fight, then who will? So there, you're right. They are dealing with some very heavy, some heavy questions there.
Well, and you mentioned kind of turning the expectations of the characters on its head. That's the black soldier saying it's, we've got to go back. Can you talk about kind of the power of flipping the stereotype there?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you think about it, in some school districts around the country, they still have been teaching a very problematic view of the Civil War. They don't even acknowledge that the war was fought over slavery. And Polacco just kind of smashes those arguments with these two characters of Pink and Say, of this young Black boy who really wants to fight for his freedom. And he knows what the war is about. It's our fight, he says. It's our war. And I think by putting that in the mouths of characters rather than just have the narration tell us that, Polacco is doing a really good job of defending the truth of the Civil War. And also the other stereotype in the book is that the Black boy can read and the white boy cannot. And she does a lot with the power of literacy in this context. And that's really valuable too, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that story is an incredibly powerful one. Highly recommend it for anybody who sounds interested in this as we're talking about it. I want to move to another choice. This is a work of historical fiction. My name is Madison Hemmings. Tell us about this one and why it made your list.
Sure. My name is James Madison Hemmings. The title character is the son of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemmings, who most of us know was enslaved by Jefferson. She had six of his children. She was Black and a teenager. He was white, wealthy, and middle-aged. She was, of course, in no position to consent to a relationship. Now, can all of this somehow be dealt with in a picture book for children? Yes. And I think the author, Jonah Winter, proves it. His young protagonist asks the same questions that we might, such as, how could a father enslave his own flesh and blood? And that's a really powerful, painful, serious question. But as young Madison ponders these difficulties, Widener's illustrations give us only portions of Jefferson. Like his children by Hemmings, readers never get access to the complete man. And it's a very somber, bittersweet at best picture book.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit more about that, about just getting kind of glimpses but not a picture of the whole man?
Yeah, I mean, that's what the boy wants, right? He wants to understand his father and all his complexity. And as he struggles to piece together his father, we as readers are put in a similar position because we see the back of his neck, we might see his hair, we might see his shoulder. We're seeing him as young Madison sees him, which is never never directly, never, you know, never face to face. And this is just the boy's attempt to get an understanding of his father. Something like an embrace, an actual touch is clearly out of the question. And young Madison is he's sad as a result of this. You know, there is no joyful ending for him. He never gets to know his father. But this is painful history. But I think it's rendered in a way that a young child can understand.
There's one other from your list that we're not going to have time to get into, To Be a Slave, sure, by Julius Lester, which it says for older children. I want to ask you, your list was kind of a mix of Black authors and white authors. I think some folks out there, maybe white parents, are wondering, are there different books that my kids should be reading? Versus, how do you kind of think about the audience's race as we're thinking about the books that are most instructive?
Well, sure. I mean, when I think about it as a parent who encouraged reading among my own children, you know, as an African-American parent, probably 98% of the books that our children are being exposed to were not written by African-Americans. And yet somehow we've managed to appreciate and intellectually engage with those stories. And so I don't think it would be much of a hardship for white parents and parents of other backgrounds to engage in stories that deal with characters of color that were written by authors of color. I don't think anyone owns the narrative. I don't think one particular type of author can share this narrative better than others. I think that many different kinds of authors are telling these stories well, and we as readers are fortunate to be able to sample them as we choose.
Do you think that white kids need to read more of these types of stories, since it's not as they're not living it every day?
Yeah, I mean, it's like I alluded to this earlier. Not only are they not living it every day, but school districts across the country are often doing a willfully poor job in sharing these experiences. And so parents do have an opportunity to supplement what their children are getting or not getting, white parents specifically, by supporting stories like these, bringing them home, and making them a part of their household.
That's Jabari Yassim. He's a writer, professor of writing and publishing at Emerson College, and he's also written several books and poems about the Black experience in America. His most recent book, which came out just last week, is called Stop and Frisk, American Poems. Jabari, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Chris. My pleasure.
This Father's Day was a little different between the pandemic and our current conversations about race. For Black fathers having those conversations with their children, it's not only a matter of education, but often survival. So today we want to talk about that, and we'll take your calls. If you're a parent, how are you talking to your kids about our current reckoning with systemic racism, police brutality? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Here with us to discuss that today is Charles Daniels, a therapist and CEO of Fathers Uplift in Dorchester, and a father himself. Charles, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Joel Christian Gill, cartoonist, historian, associate professor at the Massachusetts College of Art and Design, and also the author of several books and a father himself. Joel, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I mentioned you're both fathers. I'd love to just start asking you guys, what was going through your mind this Father's Day, considering the state of the world? I know, a nice light one to start it off.
Yeah.
Curse words, mostly. it's just like this constant, this constant battle with fearing for, raising children that are not white. Like my son goes out, he's 18, and I feel like every time he has to go out, I have to like give him a lecture about what it's like to be not white in America every single time. I mean, it's crazy. Like I'm doing that. I feel like I'm more afraid of that now than I think I've ever been afraid of it, even though this isn't new. None of the stuff that's happening is new. It's not like we just discovered this stuff. We just actually just filmed it. Right? Like it's not something that we didn't know what was going on. So I think that's mostly just, fear and exhaustion from having to continue to live in this world that treats, brown skin as a marker of you don't belong.
Yeah. And I think those
Joel,
are great.
You said your son's. Yeah.
I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry.
No. Go ahead, Charles. Go ahead, Charles.
I was just saying, I think those are great points. And for me specifically, I could tell you this is one of the saddest Father's Days I've had in a long time. And I also could say for many of us, if you pile COVID-19 on top of already having to navigate as a Black man and deal with the stresses of the world, it could be a pretty depressing and anxiety-provoking time of the year for many Black fathers in particular. One thing that I know for certain that is one of our greatest fears as fathers is to not be able to protect our children. And when you look at the media and you see what's going on currently, there is a fear, a sense of helplessness and hopelessness that may be hidden or apparent when we think about what's going to happen to our children when they leave our household in the future. And that's a thought that's going through a lot of dads' minds at this particular time, especially if they're Black.
Yeah, Joel, you mentioned your son just turned 18. Charles, I know your son is younger, 5, I believe. How are you talking to him about what's going on right now, or are you talking to him about the Black Lives Matter movement and our nation's kind of current moment?
Mostly with my son, we're getting to a point where I can actually have real conversations with him as opposed to just telling him to do the dishes. It's mostly like, one of the things I try to tell my kids all the time is that, because we live in the middle of New Hampshire, in the middle of nowhere, I call it White Conda, but, because we live in this place that's like really secluded, there's a privilege and, there are 3 police officers in our town. I know all 3 of them. I'm not afraid of them. Right. Like there's a privilege that we have that I have to start preparing him. Like this ain't going to be like the rest of the world. The rest of the world is not going to be this way. And you got to remember that. And it's just like, okay, Dad. Okay. But I'm like, no, man, you got to pay attention. Like when you get out there in the world, it's not going to be that the police officers aren't going to know your dad. You're not going to be part of this community. You're going to be completely different. And I think it's like one of the things that you have to start paying attention to, because if you like it, the consequences of not paying attention to that are disastrous.
Yeah, I'm a father myself, and I'm struck by the fact that I think all dads kind of want to protect their kids just as a basic instinct. And I'm kind of curious, Charles. I know your son is younger. How do you make these issues accessible to him? And is it something that you talk about, or do you try to protect him from a world in terms of good and evil, and trying to figure out how to navigate that?
You know, my wife and I were watching the news a while ago, and the protests were being flashed across the screens, and my son could sense that something was going on, although he did not understand. His words were, "Daddy, mommy, turn the TV," without even knowing what's currently going on in our nation. And I can tell you that as a father myself, my wife and I have really tried our best to make sure that our kid can just be a kid during this time. When the school shut down, how can he be at home and just be a kid, be happy, enjoy his imagination, play with his toys, and not be bombarded with what's going on in this world at the age of 5 years old? But I can tell you, one of the most difficult conversations that I'm regretting and that I'm not looking forward to is having with him one day is how to deal with the police officer if they pull you aside. And not only that, my wife and I are also expecting a daughter. And so when you think about dads who are currently expecting children, particularly Black fathers, the fears, the anxiety that they're currently experiencing, imagining a world that would not embrace their children's Blackness when they're born. So these are things that dads are talking about prior to the birth of their children. But I can tell you, for my son in particular, we are doing our best to let him know that there's good and evil in the world, but at the same time, he can just be a kid and have fun. We do not want to overwhelm him with what's going on in the world today. But I can tell you, he senses it.
Yeah. I'm a white father. I've yeah,
thank
absolutely.
You.
Congrats.
Thank you.
I got three of those, so.
I have to say, as a white father, I have two white sons, and I know that I will never fully understand the level of anxiety that you guys have had to deal with. I guess, can you tell us a little bit about what that is like dealing with this moment and kind of as we're seeing, as you said, Charles, every day on the news, you just kind of get bombarded with it. How challenging is that as a dad?
For me, I can tell you over the last couple of weeks, I've slumped into a severe, deeply depressive state. I can tell you the emotions that have been going through my mind as I was struggling with it. And, you know, I can tell you that I'm currently coming up out of it. The emotions that were going through my mind are sadness. I can tell you a little bit of shame and hopelessness. And I can also tell you, when you see people that look like you who are continuously being slain and killed for no apparent reason, it also makes you question your worthiness as a Black man. I'm a therapist. I have an organization serving dads that I'm privileged to work with on a day-to-day basis. But nothing can exclude the feelings that you get when you see someone that looks like you being killed for no apparent reason because of the color of their skin. So I can tell you, it's a sucky feeling to have. Also, you're also wrestling with this idea of, you know, how can I do more? Dealing with your ego, right? Feeling like you can't do something, but you want to do more than what you are currently doing now to put an end to the situation. So it's like you're stuck in between a rock and a hard place. And for me specifically, I've definitely been working on how can I be okay with what I'm doing now? But I can tell you, when you see people that look like you being shot down on a day-to-day basis, it hurts to see it happening and to feel as if you can't do anything about it. And I can tell you that many men of color are wrestling with that. What can I do more to put an end to this mistreatment of people that look like us?
I just like that feeling of depression is exactly, you know, I did a comic on my Instagram after, like, you know, when this thing first happened, I just went and bought a grill and I was going to, like, trying to perfect a brisket. That's what I spent my time doing because I could not deal with the world in and of itself, because it's just, you know, like there is a depression that you see this and you're just like, I can't sleep at night sometimes for thinking about it. And like I said, I live a pretty, I came from a rough place, but I'm no longer there. And so the stuff that, you know, that normally touches people, you know, that with poverty and having to worry about things, I don't have to really worry about that. But it's still like, I'm a human, and I see people that look like me, and I see those people out there in the world. And then you get this thing with me, with my four kids. My wife is white, so, you know, we have family members, and that within my family group, you know, it's always been this one cohesive thing, but I have this double sort of kind of thing that I have to deal with, is to explain to my children, my non-white children, they mostly consider themselves Black, that crazy uncle that posted that thing on Facebook does love you. It's just really complicated. And like, how do I get them to understand that? And how do I get that crazy uncle to also understand that that stuff is really hurtful? Do you know what I like? That sort of like really complicated thing that, you know, I have a friend who's, you know, like I went to high school with, and she has biracial children, and she just had got this like racist tirade from a family member on Facebook about All Lives Matter. And it's just like, that doesn't negate Black Lives Matter, but you won't say it. And I don't like, it's just like there's a constant thing that it's just like, you know, you get little bits and pieces of things where you see that there might be hope in the world, but then there's stuff that takes us way back, like this, right? Like this thing takes us way back. So, I draw comics and try to change the world, but sometimes it's just, you know, I got to cook a brisket.
Hey, everybody's got to cook a brisket sometimes, man.
I love that.
I want to go to the phones here. 1-800-423-8255. Noreen in Alston, what's on your mind, Noreen?
Okay. I want to thank you guys for giving me the privilege of expressing my opinion in regards to the racism and stuff that's going on. I just want to say that I feel that Black people are treated, it's a psychological warfare. The country and a lot of parts of the world, they have the highest expectation of Black people as a race. They don't realize the ones of us that realize our fullest potential, and the ones that need to realize their fullest potential are not enabled to do that. It seems as if everything is stacked up against us. I have two Black boys, and they try their very best. They're well-behaved people. They're very responsible people. And I want the world to look at them as such. And if America needs to be great all the time, then everyone in America needs to be treated the same way. Instead of putting money into police brutality and supporting that, why don't we support better education for everyone? My kids, they always excelled in school, but because they never gave problems, they were never focused on, they were never looked upon. They were content to be where they were instead of being pushed to be even better than up to their fullest potential. So the point is, if any race at all are treated like Black people, we would get the same results. So I think it's about time birth rates are down. Everyone is expected to carry their own weight. And I want to know when the people in government are going to treat Black people like the people who've been here building this country forever. Other nationalities come here and they're able to find their way. Yet even they turn around and oppress Black people. So the point is, we're no different from anyone else. Maslow has the hierarchy of need. Every human needs that.
Yeah, we're
really
not.
I appreciate the call and the perspective. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah,
go
we're
ahead,
not. Joel. That's really interesting. That's a thing that we're not different. But, you know, like I've said this and I read it somewhere and I don't remember where I read it, but Black people in America really epitomize the E pluribus unum, because we were many different ethnic and cultural people that were brought here. And because of white supremacy and that idea that you needed to hold people as property, we were made one giant group. And then that group was criminalized for the next 400 years into a sense that we right now in this quote unquote colorblind society, we legitimately are not looking at what actually is causing a lot of the problems, right? The increasing militarization of the police, the insistent on arrest, the idea of intentional bias, and how that plays out. That's like and then poor police training. I got tattoos on both of my arms. In order to get those tattoos, I had to go to somebody who had 12 months of training and got a license and had to spend most of that time in an apprenticeship. 12 months. Most police training in America is 22 weeks, and most of it is less than that. So you take 22 weeks, you give them a lot of money, you give them a lot of money in federal money for making arrest, you allow them to have implicit bias and poor training. It's the perfect storm. It actually starts working the way it's supposed to.
I do want to ask, because it does feel like we're maybe possibly starting to have these conversations in a real way that can lead to systemic change. Are you guys as fathers optimistic for your children's futures in any way? I know it's a mixed bag here. You've talked about all the incredible anxiety and depression that you've had to deal with and kind of searching for that sense of value. But how are you processing our current moment?
I think for me specifically, I can tell you that I'm optimistic about my son not becoming a victim of the hate in this world. Am I optimistic that people that look like me will stop being killed? I can't really answer that question. You know, I feel as if we're in a modern day tug of war period. And what does that mean is that we have media, the world suggesting one thing about, well, blacks are not valuable. And on the flip side, you have fathers that are in the household telling their kids otherwise. Ignore what you see on TV. Know how important you are. We love you. We care about you. Your blackness is not a curse. And I feel as if both of these messages are being instilled in our children and households throughout America. So I'm very optimistic that my message in my household for my black son and my black daughter is going to be powerful. They're going to know their worth. They're going to know how to deal with the police officer should they be pulled over, right? But I am not quite convinced at this particular time that our government and the systems that continue to oppress black people are ready to make a change. I'm not there yet. And unfortunately, I wish I was, but at this particular time, I'm optimistic about the great human beings my kids are going to be, but I am not optimistic about where our country is headed until real change takes place.
Joel, just got about 30 seconds. Last word to you.
I am cautiously optimistic. America has a problem with race, like addicts have a problem with addiction. In order to fix it, you actually have to recognize there's a problem. And until we recognize that problem, we're going to continue to do this.
That's Joel Christian Gill, cartoonist, historian, and associate professor at the Massachusetts College of Art and Design, and Charles Daniels, therapist and CEO of Fathers Uplift in Dorchester. Thank you so much, both of you, for being here with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston's produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Paris Olson, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Jimmy Kiesling. Our executive producer is Satesh Hathi. I'm Chris Siderick. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.